What a beautiful sound. And the most beautiful thing about the sound is not the manifested sound, but the stillness that's listening. And this is how sense perceptions can also become a doorway, an opening. There's the manifested, to the mind, it's only the sound of rain. It could explain it scientifically, how the sound is produced. But if you listen in stillness, then you're aware of the unmanifested. You are the awareness in which the sound happens. And any sense perception can bring an opening into that. And you're aware not only of that which is being perceived, but also of yourself, not the egoic self, but of yourself as the consciousness in which the sound happens, which is stillness. And that's where this, that which you cannot analyze or define or explain mentally, that's where the peace comes from that is there. You're aware of yourself as consciousness. Consciousness is aware of itself. Language is strange. And especially sense perceptions that are of anything that has not come into existence through human intervention, those things are particularly helpful. Anything that comes into existence through human intervention usually has some mind to it. It could stimulate mind more easily. But even there, if you're really present, you could watch a car like that also. But the rain takes you there more easily. And there's great beauty in going into nature and being the perceiving consciousness. Peace in which all that happens. To look at a tree and be aware of yourself as the awareness. And you might not put it like that. You can just, somebody might say, there's deep peace in that. It's enough. And at some point you could even watch the TV news. And be there in the peace, and things get transformed through that. There's a suggestion in one of the questions before we conclude. It says, could we visualize for peace in the world? Let's see. We're doing that already at this moment. Before we disperse, I wonder if this group could spend a few moments visualizing peace in the world. I feel such power in our deepening presence. So, that's happening already. And then be aware of that awareness even when there's turmoil that you watch around you. There's a core of peace in the midst of turmoil. And that transforms the world. The turmoil is ultimately a dream, the collective dream of form, the collective dream of clashing forms. All identified with form, lost in the dream of form. And not to give that dream absolute reality and see, this is dreadful, dreadful. A question about its presence, the state of presence. There seems to be a state that requires effort to maintain. The one that comes and goes, that people avoid life in order to maintain. Please describe the difference between this apparent state and our true nature. How can the inquiry, who am I, be brought into our sessions with people? Well, we just practiced the who am I when we were listening to the rain. Not in those words. And when you're sitting with someone, who am I is one of those pointers that you could use in itself. It's nothing, but it points you back to the awareness that you are. And at some point you don't need that pointer anymore. You don't need to continue to ask yourself, who am I? You know yourself as the awareness. When you're still inside, you don't need to ask yourself, who am I anymore, of course. It's just that who am I is a thought, the last thought, hopefully. Now, is effort required to be present? It sometimes may sound like it, but effort is not really compatible with presence, because effort implies reaching out towards something. That's effort. It's always you're not quite there. I have to get there. Where are you trying to get to the present moment? Have to stay present. Stay present. I lost it. So it's not really effort that is required. When the mind looks at what we are doing, it might think, okay, now I have to really make an effort to be present. But its effort implies some point in the future or somewhere else that you need to get to. So it's not that, but there is an intensity there in presence that the mind could mistake for effort. And what is the relationship then between the natural, as the questioner says, your true nature and that state of presence? If it is a state, may not be a good word. Does a state come and go, or is a state permanent? I don't know. A condition comes and goes. A state could be permanent. Words. Your true nature is already the case. The flower, the tree, the animal, they are at home within themselves in their true nature. And so are humans. But they have the dream of not being at home. But that's all very good. And then humans wake up to their true nature. They realize, they become conscious of their true nature. Something that before was already there is now becoming conscious. You can go to sleep, and in dreamless sleep, you merge completely with the unmanifested. And you are merged with that anyway, and then you wake up again into the dream of form that you identify with and take that to be absolute reality. Our task as humans is to know our true nature, to consciously go into sleep. one could almost say, which is the stillness. But effort doesn't get you there. It wants to happen. That's why you, from an external perspective, why we seem to be engaged in doing this practice, which isn't even a practice. We are engaged in this because this very event, us sitting here, is part of the emerging consciousness that comes through humans, where the universe is becoming aware of itself. And whatever we say in language is a limited perspective. It's not, no words could contain the absolute truth here. Just a few helpful hints. There's an evolutionary impulse at work. And us being here is part of that. There is an emerging consciousness. There is a freeing of consciousness from the dream of form. There is an universal awakening happening. There is no end to the questions that the mind could then ask about it. To what end? And what happens after that? And what's the purpose in that? And then what? So, up to a point, it's helpful to see a few things and then leave that behind, the continuous search for explanations, because that keeps you on the level of mind. That has its place. You have to know when it's time to step beyond further questioning. Typical questions where you get stuck is, I want to learn more about presence. Can you explain a bit more? I haven't quite understood it, not fully. Of course not. As the famous Zen dialogue goes, disciple asks the master, no, the master asks the disciple, do you understand Zen? The disciple says, no, master, I don't. And master says, neither do I. Now, there's something that comes that the mind does not like at all. At some point, you give up trying to understand. And for many spiritual seekers, that can be the last obstacle, or one of the last, sometimes the last. Trying to understand, I have to understand. Before I can teach, I have to understand this fully. No, you don't. You can't. But then how can I explain if people ask me questions I won't know the answer? If the answer is needed, if it's a true question, and a vital question, then the answer will be there the moment the answer is required. But that is it's a great thing when you realize it is time to give up trying to figure out and to understand the universe, myself, my relationship to the world, what I'm here for. It's so vast you can't possibly understand it. The vastness even that you are, you can't possibly understand it. Being it, yes. And so it's a relief that you don't need to understand. When I became peaceful suddenly, I didn't understand more. In fact, one could easily say that I understood much less than before when I was in turmoil. So that is the great renunciation also. To renounce having to understand. And then, out of that, something does arise, a deep knowing that is beyond concepts, that is not easy to put into words, or you can't put into words. So it is the shift from being based in thinking to being based, and of course just language, in awareness. The shift from thinking to awareness is one way of putting it that is happening in humanity, the evolutionary leap that is going to save humanity if it happens, and it is happening. The evolutionary leap from thought, mind-based creatures to creatures rooted in awareness. And it is quite possible that a day comes on the planet when humans, I'm not going to say much more about this, but I got to go into that kind of thing. But if any of you are science fiction writers, you can pick it up as an idea. It may not be easy to write about this, because a time may come when humans on the planet don't think anymore. Neither do they speak anymore. An intelligence that is greater than the limited mind with its thought forms, its conditioned thought forms, then operates, and they walk about in complete stillness. And whatever they need to communicate is immediately transmitted, but not through concepts. Now, I don't know how interesting a film would be about that. The film would only become interesting if some unenlightened being arrives in that world. Because then there can be some drama. When I wake up in the morning, I feel so happy and blissful that I have no desire to go into the world and achieve things. I've put up a list of goals next to my bed, and that helps. But I'm so happy just as I am, it seems like a problem. I could lay there for hours. Sometimes I do. Well, I can't see the problem, but... If I remember correctly, in ancient Greece, to be a member of the Senate, one of the requirements was, don't know the exact number of years, one of the requirements was not to have done anything for 10 years or so. There's great wisdom in that. Now imagine writing that in your resume. (laughs) 1990 to 2000, did nothing. It sometimes happens, particularly in those humans in whom that peace that comes with the awakened consciousness comes suddenly. It sometimes happens that they find it difficult to continue to operate in the world. It's so sudden, that change, from being run by desire and fear, which is what keeps people going mostly in this world. Fear drives you to do things, and the wanting drives you to do things. I want that, but I fear that, so I have to be active so that this doesn't happen. I need the security, I need to... And when that goes, suddenly... It seems the motivation for action has disappeared. As if it happened suddenly, this happened to me also. And I spent quite a few years doing nothing and miraculously survived. I'm not saying that this is what you should do. In most of you, the arising is more gradual. So you have time to find a way of incorporating the new state into being in the world and finding a way of being active that is not dominated by fear or desire. A new way of doing that does not have the underlying energy field of fear or fearing or wanting. And of course that implies that kind of doing comes out of the joy of being. There is joy in that kind of doing when it's not run by fear and desire. So you then learn to do what is needed in this world, no longer the obsessive doing, the obsessive and excessive doing that most people are engaged in because they need to become somebody and add more to me, and that not that kind of doing, but doing that is part of being here as a form, and that involves being engaged in some kind of activity without loss of peace. In fact, and activities into which peace flows, joy, that is peace, peace and joy are one, as the most essential energy in the doing. And so if presence arises very suddenly in you, then you may take years before you can fully live again and interact with the world in that new state. Maybe not. Maybe if you have the help of a teaching, you can more quickly incorporate it and then begin to live it in this world. It took Ramana Maharshi many years before he could operate normally again. He couldn't even speak or had no desire to speak anymore. He didn't even want to feed himself anymore. What for? And so he just sat immersed in the bliss of being for years. It was his great luck that it didn't happen to him in the West, because probably he would have spent the rest of his days in a mental home. But he was there in India, and people came to feed him. They left him, but somebody always would come and feed him, and gradually he would start putting food in his mouth and showing some interest in the external, never an excessive interest, but just looking. And then people would ask questions, and at first there was no answer, and then at some point he started scribbling an answer, and then he was able to speak again. And then became quite, could function quite normally, but always, of course, with great stillness. And something happened to me that is similar, although not as extreme, fortunately, otherwise I wouldn't be here, I would still be shut away. The complete loss of interest in future, the complete loss of all ambition, of achievement, of doing anything, that lasted for a few years. And then gradually, the ability came back to do, but in a very different way, doing with peace and joy. With most of you, it arises more gradually, so you can more easily find a way of incorporating that into your life. But for some people, there may come a time when you feel it's pointless to do anything because it's so good to just be. Or maybe you just do the minimum. There are people to whom this has happened who gave up great jobs in the world and became gardeners or things that was, they could easily stay, very easily stay present. They did manual jobs. They gave up the reputable job and just did the minimum of what was required. All these things, there can be no predicting what will happen as this shift happens within you. But it is possible and it is beautiful. You are not condemned to passivity now. In fact, as you learn to live in that beautiful state, then whatever you do, when you finally do, has the creative spark to it. It has quality to it. whatever it is, whether it's a simple movement of picking up garbage in the park, then you are enlightened park attendant. Not, hopefully you don't have a conceptual identity about yourself as that, because you're nobody, of course. If you are somebody picking up garbage in the park, you'll be unhappy. But if you're nobody picking up garbage in the park, every movement is beautiful. And there's a quality to that. Wonderful. Or whatever it is. So some people feel called upon to let go of their complicated life and do something more simple. It's possible. Or perhaps you can somehow introduce that simplicity into your complexity and transform the complexity and make it all more simple. And then become an attorney at law that does things differently. Is that possible within the structures? I don't know. There are people who have companies who do things differently. My publisher does things differently. It's a company where everybody has a share in the profit that's generated. Every employee. New World Library. And they're all very happy. It is possible. Some of the structures are still capable of change if conscious humans are in there. And other structures are so rigid that they are incapable of change. So what happens to you as this arises? Just see. You will make it, you will survive, even if you do nothing for a while, if that is what you are called to do or not to do. Be careful with the mind making it into a problem. My mind had given up by then, and the only remnant that was left of problem was an innocent question that the mind would sometimes ask when I was sitting there on park benches. And the question was, how can you be so happy? I don't understand that. It doesn't make sense. But fortunately, the mind didn't pursue it any further. It asked the question and then it gave up. If the mind had pursued it further, it would have become a problem. I don't understand. I need to understand. And even now, in my life, there are always periods when I do nothing. It is very beautiful. I sit in my room, maybe an hour, 2 hours, or out in nature, just being. There's great beauty in that, in just being. Or sit in the car. If there's a traffic jam, beautiful, just being, nowhere to go, nothing to do, just such aliveness. Waiting at the airport, of course, if you go into mind, then comes, this is preposterous. What are they, what do they think they're doing? couple of questions about money or charging when you see people, whether to, what is the right way? Is it right to charge money for spiritual teaching? Can you charge money for space? How much is space? The first thing to remember about this is one of the favorite ways of the mind of adopting a position, because many people have an issue with money because it's connected with survival and me surviving and making it. And so when you talk about it, to be aware that the mind will use it as a wonderful opportunity to identify with a mental position about it, of right and wrong. An emotionally charged mental position. And when you notice it in yourself, that's enough to notice it. And you're not trapped in the mental position. I could speak to you for the next 10 or 20 minutes on why you should certainly not charge. And it will make complete sense why it is right not to charge for spiritual teaching. And then I could speak to you for 20 minutes to say why it is right that you should charge. And neither one nor the other is right. They are both right. There are two ways. There are ways of doing things. To do with the world of form. No more. And the mind can use it as a wonderful opportunity to focus on something on the level of form to avoid the formless. In this teaching, for maybe 10 or 12 years, all the teaching I did was either by donation or with a minimum charge. Now, for the past few years, there has been a charge. The strange thing is, the average number of people who came to my intensives when our church was charging donations was 15. Now the cycle came of charging for the teaching, and the charging is to do with the form, not with the essence of the teaching. It's to do with the needs on the physical level of structures, physical structure, where one lives, where one meets, tapes. Everything has a physical aspect. Even when a spiritual teaching comes into this world, it somehow must have a physical aspect. There's a book. Everything, this mic is physical, the room is a physical structure, mailing lists are physical, tapes are physical, people are traveling, this body travels from here to there. So inevitably, that comes in, and money is connected with the world of form, one way or another. There are organizations, spiritual organizations, they offer free teaching, and that's beautiful. Very often, at some point, as you become associated with the organization, you will realize that, yes, there is an expectation that you should contribute part of your income. to keep the external form of it going. And the Buddha was given land so that the monastery could be there, that was form. And yet how easy it is for the form to take over and obscure the essence of the teaching, which is, has also happened in many organizations. The form, which was just there to enable that which is beyond form to get out into the world, grew and obscured the essence. And everybody was only concerned with the institution, the external structures of the form. And even money was then became part of it. So there's the danger, of course, that this can happen. Personally, I feel that there are certain cycles. There was a cycle in this teaching where things were free or at a minimum. There's a cycle that came, it was this, when great numbers of people came and there was a charge and it worked beautifully. Thousands and thousands and thousands were reached and are being reached. And yet I feel that here too a transition is coming. And I cannot tell you yet what form the teaching will take in the future. All I know is that right now that there's a transitional point that's being reached in the form that this teaching takes. It's been perfectly fine up to this point, but I do feel that coming. So when we meet again, then perhaps we'll know what it is and what external form the teaching takes. Will it be free? Who knows, perhaps. And so only you can know what is right for you, what feels right, and you will always meet somebody else who questions that. I felt wonderful about not charging for many years until I met somebody who came. I told the story in the last practicing presence retreat when the same question came up. Somebody called me up and said, "Can I come to you for a session?" "Yes." Said, "How much do you charge?" Said, "There is no charge, donation only." Said, okay. And then she came and said, "I almost did not come because you obviously don't value your work. You don't value what you do." I said, "Oh, how is that?" "Well, you don't charge for what you do. If it's valuable." And then she talked to me for an hour about that I was wrong not to charge and left without leaving a donation. Spiritual teaching is something new for the West. The West has had institutionalized priests and so on. But spiritual teachings, especially that are not really part of an institution, a spiritual teacher is something new in the West. There's not really traditional spiritual teachers. Maybe the last spiritual teachers they had were the Middle Ages, the mystics, but even the mystics were somehow associated with the church, although the church didn't like them at all. And so there is no tradition of that in the West as there is in India, where in India people are naturally generous. They provide for the livelihood of the spiritual teacher. The few Indians who have come to me in the West, when I first started teaching in the West, I was always amazed at they don't even ask how much you charge. They assume that you don't charge, and they give very generously. And it's beautiful. And a friend of mine is a spiritual teacher who now lives in the West, an Indian woman doing good work. And she had a guru in India, and she visited the guru in India. And her guru in India said, somehow she must have mentioned to her that she charges for her work in the West. And her guru said, this is absolutely wrong. You must not charge. You are a prostitute if you charge for spiritual teaching. Stop charging. She said, oh, sorry. She went back to the West and then called up everybody and said, I'm not charging anymore. This is it. You can leave donations if you like. And so people continued to come, and there was no charge anymore. And she's a funny story. Her income was dwindling, and paying the mortgage was getting difficult. That's the world of form. She was not being sustained by an institution. She lived alone. And one day a woman came, and she knew she was wealthy, and she just said, she showed her, she just bought these two or three beautiful dresses and some, look at that, isn't that great? And it only costs $500 per dress. And then she left a donation. She didn't see, this my friend explained to me, she didn't see the discrepancy. She left, don't know how much, $10 or $20 after a wonderful session, said, oh, this was so beautiful. You've given me so much. And then and my friend, the teacher, said, and I felt angry, she said. And then she started charging again. There is no right or wrong here. You need to feel what is right for you at any, and what is right today may not be right tomorrow. There are cycles in life. There are ways of doing things, and there are cycles. Then in my life there was a cycle of inactivity, and there was a cycle of activity. There may again come a cycle of relative inactivity on the external level. And there can be cycles in the world of form, where you do things differently on the level of form. So let's wait and see what happens. On the level of form, as far as this teaching is concerned. Beware of emotionally charged, as I mentioned at the beginning, emotionally charged positions around money, as many people have. They are very spiritual until it's to do with business, until it's to do with their investment, meeting their investment advisor, and the collapsing stock market, or the real estate deal that's not going through. And they lose it. It's to do with fear and survival, and the need for position. I enjoy the relative abundance on the external level that is in my life now. There's money in the bank, which is never happened before. And so it's a new experience. It's enjoyable, but that's enough. I've had the experience now. I never felt poor when I had no money, somehow, from an external viewpoint, people would have said, this person lives below the poverty line. And if I had known that, I might have felt bad about it. And occasionally I lived in places when people visited me, they were shocked. How can you live like that? Like what? Well, the mattress on the floor and an old table and a chair. How can you live like that? What's wrong with that? For 15 years, my means of transportation in my adult life was a bicycle. Beautiful. I cycled around London for years in the midst of traffic. I enjoyed it greatly. One day my father arrived and he saw my bike. He said, he was in the hotel, we were looking out of the window. I said, do you see down there? That's my bike. He said, what? He felt so sorry for me. It was dreadful. I must give you some money. I said, why? You're reduced to riding a bike at your age? Now I drive an SUV. And some people say that's definitely not the car that Jesus would drive. Maybe I'm using up my environmental credits accumulated during 15 years of cycling. But sitting in a nice, comfortable car doesn't really feel any better than a bicycle. They're both beautiful, just equally enjoyable. Or walking. There's great beauty in walking. So it's to just enjoy whatever comes to you in the phenomenal realm, and things change all the time. So certain things come for a while, the forms come, and yes, you experience the forms, you play with it. Abundance is not really to do with how much you have on the external level. I felt so abundant sitting on a park bench. True abundance comes from being, out of being. Being is abundant. It is the fullness of life. Jesus talks about it, the fullness of life. Sometimes he calls it, it's translated as abundant life. Not many things. He never talked about accumulating things. So it's not accumulating, don't need to accumulate anything, but things may come to you. Why not enjoy what comes? And then things may leave you or you leave them. That's beautiful too. The Buddha left everything behind, walked away. And later things came to him again. It didn't matter anymore, but even on a material level, there were possessions. The monastic order was given vast amounts of land, beautiful gardens. That came. It didn't matter at all. But it's enjoyable, yes. Any egoic remnants that are left in you, money is a favorite way of activating those. They activate themselves again through that. And this is why the gurus, many gurus have fallen, especially gurus who came from the East, unused to the ways of the West. They came to the East and were confronted with money, sex, and power. The three things that can easily reactivate the ego. Do you have any suggestions for the family members of or the persons with Alzheimer's disease where the loss is progressing relatively gradually? That is a strange thing, the loss of memory. Being with someone, if the loss is happening slowly, directing attention within, away from mind, because mind is going anyway by itself. So directing attention away from thought into the aliveness that is within. That's a beautiful thing you can do with the person when you sit with them. Instead of trying to remember things that you could, eventually that will go. It's a very peculiar phenomenon. I don't have very much personal experience with meeting people who have that. The mother of a friend of mine has Alzheimer's. And in her particular case, he told me, his mother was unhappy all her life, tortured by thoughts about her miserable life, interpreting everything negatively. And he said, when she was beginning to lose her memory, she was happy for the first time in her life. This doesn't happen. Some Alzheimer patients are not happy, I know that. And it may also be that the pain body comes up more strongly. But in her particular case, as the thinking faculty diminished, she experienced freedom from the burden of thought. But of course, with Alzheimer, you're moving below thought. It can be a way, it is perhaps a way of the organism to free itself from the torture of the mind. The body says, I have had enough. We are going to switch that thing off. I can't stand this anymore, because the body has enormous intelligence And the body does things sometimes to just, that's it, I've had enough. And so the greater intelligence said, no more of this. And it finds the off switch. I have no scientific proof for this, but I would suggest that as you find inner stillness, it is less likely that this will happen to you because you voluntarily step out of mind. The body doesn't have to do it for you. You voluntarily step out into stillness. And the body loves that. The body does not love the mind. It creates so much havoc in the body. An interesting study was made some years ago by a psychologist connected with Alzheimer's disease. Usually these things these days, the way they study them is on the level of brain chemistry and so on, because medicine, even psychology, is to a large extent addresses the material aspect, the physical aspect of illness. Even the mind is studied in that way. But a psychologist did a strange study. He went to there was a large convent somewhere in the States, and some of those nuns who lived all their life in that convent developed Alzheimer, a certain percentage, normal percentage. And what he did, he studied the initial letters that each young nun wrote when they applied to be accepted in the convent. And he could predict, he could tell from the way not the writing, but the way in which the letters were written, with a great degree of accuracy, who would develop Alzheimer and who would not develop Alzheimer. And what he looked at was originality of expression, whether the writing had a spark of creativity to it, or whether it was a conventional use of language without the spark that comes, the creative spark that comes into writing when you are connected with something within you that is deeper than the mind. So those that had the creative spark in their writing did not develop Alzheimer. So I don't know whether he came to that conclusion that I drew from it or whether he left it at that. So those who were already connected with even perhaps in a small area of their lives, in perhaps only a tiny opening into the unconditioned consciousness that is beyond the conditioned mind. Those that had that did not develop Alzheimer. They had the connection to perhaps there was the stillness there, a link, not perhaps totally. And those that didn't have it, he predicted, were much more likely to develop that. That's a very interesting study. So I believe that it is far less likely to happen to you as you voluntarily exit the stream of thinking, so to speak. Then you won't have to be pushed out of the stream of thinking, or the stream of thinking doesn't have to be switched off for you. So we do not know what awareness remains in those human beings to whom it happens. I have briefly observed some of them, but have never had a long interaction. In some, there was definitely an aware presence still there without the memory. There's a beautiful story in a book that I was given recently. I don't remember the title. Small Graces or something like that. Where he visits an old people's home, the author, and meets an old woman. And all she does, she spends her time looking out of the window. She can't move very much anymore. And he comes into her room. Whether she has Alzheimer or not, or big early stages, I don't know. And she looks out of the window and he came to her ready to feel great pity for this person who is reduced to staring out of the window. And she directed his attention to look at the tree, look at the clouds, look at the sky, how beautiful. Just look, and you're right. Her life had become reduced to a window, and it was enough because she went so deeply into that perception, she needed no more. She taught him, he was ready to feel pity for her, and he learned a beautiful lesson of looking without thought. Just looking. So wonderful to be here with myself. There may be some questions that haven't been answered, but I keep all the questions, so at some point you might see an answer somewhere. By then you will have forgotten the question. On the formal level, every ending is a little death. And there's great beauty in that. Because all it happens, it ends on the level of form. This particular form comes to an end. The gathering. The essence of the form does not end.